It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Table. We're joined by a couple different experts in the legislative field, some folks who joined me on the Hill a bunch of times. We've got Jason Breifel from Professional Managers Association, Greg Stanford from Federal Managers Association, and Jessica Clement from National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, or NARF. So thank you for coming, you guys. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So glad to have you guys here. And just a quick reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. So lots of stuff going on the Hill, some of it VA related, others of it. There are a lot of things for federal employees, although VA seems to take up the headlines. But that doesn't mean that other things that federal employees should be concerned about aren't out there. And so that's sort of why I thought it's a good time as we're cruising quickly into summer and towards the August recess to let people know what's out there, what Congress is up to, and what federal employees can expect. So, you know, it'd be great, though, if you could each tell me a little bit about your associations and just give people a quick background of where you're from. Greg, Federal Managers Association.
Sure. The Federal Managers Association, we represent managers and supervisors across the federal government, more than 40 agencies. We've been around for over 100 years. And we have a large Department of Defense population, but as I said, we have folks at IRS, Social Security, and more than 40 different agencies and departments, and happy to be with you today.
Great. Well, thanks for coming. Jesse, why don't you give us a little background on NARF? I know a lot of people know all three of these associations, but give us the rundown on what you guys are working on. And
always happy to talk about NARF, Jenny. Thanks. NARF is the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. We are a 250,000 membership organization for active and retired federal employees. I know many people think of NARF as the retiree organization. That's how we started. We have since branched out to include active federal employees as well. We have chapters across the country, some overseas. I have no doubt for your listeners, there's a NARF chapter close to them, if there isn't. And like you said, there are a wide range of things going on the Hill right now, and we are watching all of them very closely.
Great. And Jason.
Good morning, Jenny. Thanks for having me today. The Professional Managers Association is the professional association for higher-level managers, primarily at the IRS, but also in other agencies. And I appreciate you having me this morning.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. So, you know, what's out there, everybody, you know, set VA aside, because that's something that everybody hears about right now. But what else is running around? Because there are things that Congress is moving and are considering, the defense authorization, appropriations. So sometimes it seems like nothing's moving in Congress, but things are. So are there things that federal employees should be on the lookout for? I know House has passed the defense authorization, and you've got Senate getting ready to take it up. What is in there? There's not as much as previous years. So,
well, we all remember the heydays of 2009, which was a really, really good year for federal employees, and most of those provisions, such as the first sick leave, was included in the FY10 NDAA. Much to our surprise, I don't think we really realized it until a few months ago, the reemployed annuitants provision, which allowed federal retirees to come back to federal service part-time without offset to their annuity, which was also included in that bill, had a five-year sunset. And much to my own surprise, it is 5 years later. So all of us in this room have been working hard to make sure that provision gets extended. We were thankful that Congressman Connolly from Virginia wanted to take up this issue. He successfully introduced an amendment to this year's NDAA, which was ultimately included in the bill. The Senate bill has passed committee, but from what I hear, they're not going to take this up until probably July. And just speaking on behalf of all the organizations in this room, we are working on finding a way to get that provision in that bill as well.
And I think to remind listeners what reemployed annuitants is, it allows agencies, I guess the technical term is the dual compensation waiver. So it allows people to reemploy somebody who's already retired without penalty to that employee's annuity. And so it's a great, at least from the management perspective, and I'll stick my Senior Executives Association hat on here, you know, or Government Managers Coalition, which a lot of our groups have been involved in, is, you know, it's a great way, especially when they're not backfilling positions, to get people into those jobs and have some continuity, mentoring, succession planning, all that. So
for as important as we thought this provision was back in 2009, I think it is exponentially more important today. Yep. As agencies are under hiring freezes, sequestration level funding, they can't backfill positions the way they would probably like to. How better than to bring back a retiree who knows the issue, who can train the person, mentor the individual who is most likely to hopefully one day take that job.
Right. And it's a time limit. They're not in that job indefinitely. So, you know, it's a short amount of time. It seems to make sense for a lot of agencies. But, you know, that's, where does the time go? It was 5 years and, you know, everybody went, wow.
I'd like to think that I haven't aged a day.
That's right. So, you know, but that's definitely something that's moving that I think will help agencies. Greg, I know you guys were working on an amendment, working with some folks in the House to pass some things on the NDAA as well.
Exactly. We worked with Representative Derek Kilmer from Washington State and Tom Cole from Oklahoma on a bipartisan amendment regarding the Working Capital Fund, which is a revolving fund that it's a model that doesn't work off of annual appropriations. It's more of a self-sustaining contracts, and it's independent of annual appropriations.
And it's at DOD?
It's at DOD. Across every component and every base. And our concern was we didn't want Working Capital Fund employees to be subject to furloughs, because furloughing these employees wouldn't save any appropriations dollars. And in fact, it would actually cost the country money, because you're delaying contracts, you're going into to off year or to out years. And your ROI is going to be awful. So it not only is it not a savings, but it's a huge cost. It's something that we've been working on for well over a year from when sequestration was first enacted. And so we were delighted to work with Mr. Kilmer and Mr. Cole on the amendment, which was agreed to and in the House and attached to the NDAA.
Well, and you kind of hope furloughs aren't going to happen again, but
sure.
I like to never say never, because we've got, what, 70% of sequestration still in place, and you never know what comes. I think people never thought we'd get government shut down, get furloughs in the first place.
Exactly.
And here we are. So is this something you guys are working in the Senate also to get on the NDAA and hopefully move forward?
That's our next steps, is we're going to keep hitting it. We were delighted that to work and to get it done in the House. And, you know, the next steps and strategy is certainly to keep pushing with the Senate.
Yeah.
And to make sure that it's part of the final product that, right, that goes to the president.
And I think for people listening, I always, you know, it's that sort of how a bill becomes a law. Go back to that is, you know, it, just because something passes in the House, the Senate usually passes their own version of the same bill, and then they conference it together and decide what's going to be in the final product. So we often talk about passing things in both chambers, and that still doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be in the final, but certainly gives us all something to work for. So, and I think there were a few other amendments on the NDAA, something with overtime as well.
There was another one also introduced by Representative Kilmer, excuse me, allowing overtime at some of the DOD facilities overseas in Japan. These are employees that will receive a per diem. You know, they're on TDY. And there's a lot of work to be done over there, and the Navy had stopped overtime at those facilities. Well, what that means is then you need more people to go to get the work done, which is ultimately more expensive because they're on TDY and they receive a per diem and housing allowances. So the Kilmer Amendment, which I believe also passed as part of the NDAA, would allow DOD to restore overtime at those facilities.
You know, that's one of the interesting amendments to me, because everybody talks about furloughs or cutting budgets, and then we make these decisions that aren't necessarily going to save money. And that was one of the things that I know all of our groups have brought up before, is that you have to think about kind of some of the long-term steps here of whether it's really going to save money and be good for the workforce or not. And, you know, the other interesting thing I think about NDAA, because I think those were primarily most of the broad federal workforce related things, is in years past, we've been fighting amendments.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And we weren't fighting amendments this time. There weren't the pay freeze, the, you know, official time, the, some of those others out
arbitrary
there.
Arbitrary across the board workforce cuts, which we actually had anticipated being in this bill because it's getting a lot of attention. Representative Calvert's bill to cut 5% of DOD employees, we were ready to go on that one, and that didn't end up in the bill.
Yeah, I mean, so it's actually in some ways maybe not been as tough a year in terms of the NDA so far. I'm going to knock on wood and not jinx myself on that.
We got another chamber and conference still to go.
So, and while we're talking about that, I'm going to take our first break here, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about appropriations and some of the other things we've mentioned. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll continue our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, we're hosting a legislative roundtable to talk about what federal employees should be on the lookout for in Congress right now and in the next couple months. And we just finished talking about the defense authorization and the fact that there wasn't much on there, but that's something all of our groups have always been on the lookout for, is both as a place to look for ways to pass good beneficial legislation, but also to stop things that would adversely affect federal employees. But another place where that's happening a lot more is appropriations. Mm-hmm. You know, that used to be just the spending stuff. And now we see amendments, we see other things. And Jesse, you mentioned this idea to do workforce cuts, and that's something that's been talked about for defense appropriations.
Yep. I think it's going to be talked about in every appropriations bill. The saving grace with that is that if something like federal workforce cuts are included in appropriations bills, it's very difficult to write that in a way that carries it out for a year, for longer than a year. Appropriations bills are usually just for that year alone. We do expect some sort of fight on workforce cuts in the appropriations process, particularly in the DOD appropriations. So we'll be watching for that, just because in committee markups and hearings, Congressman Calvert's been very, very strong on this.
You know, and I think the other thing that everybody asks about appropriations is the pay raise for federal employees, because that's where it comes from, is in the general government financial services appropriations. And in the last couple of years, they've been silent on a pay raise. And, you know, that's my question to you. Pull out your crystal ball. And do you think we're going to see a pay raise for federal employees this year or no?
I think that once again, they'll probably be silent on this issue. You know, there are bills out there that would both in the House and the Senate to provide a 3.3% raise for federal employees. That's the FAIR Act. And but just despite that legislation being out there, I think in terms of the appropriations, they're going to stick with the trend and remain silent on this one once again.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, we should probably point out that if appropriations is silent, then the pay raise authority goes to the president. Ultimately, the decision lies with Congress. If Congress does not specify a raise or specify no raise, the president has the authority to implement a raise as he sees fits, which is what happened this year with the 1% pay raise. The president has again proposed a 1% pay raise for federal employees in 2015. I think looking into the crystal ball, I think Jason's probably right. I think it's likely appropriations will remain silent and the president's 1% pay raise will go into effect.
You know, but it'd be interesting because they've given, what, 1.8 mm-hmm. or talking about 1.8 for the military. And years and years ago, well, I guess it's years ago now.
It is years and years ago now.
I can say that. It's, you know, we used to have pay parity where they'd try to give federal employees and military the same pay raise. And there was a lot of bipartisan support for that. And I don't know. I think I've heard somebody mention pay parity recently, but I don't know that there's been a lot of calls for equalizing that pay again.
Well, NARF is going to call for that. We haven't yet met with the Financial Services Appropriations folks yet, but we are intending to ask once again for pay parity for a 1.8% pay raise. Tapping into my memory bank prior to the pay freezes, if I recall correctly, I believe it was 25 out of the last 20, the previous 26 years, so the years preceding 2011, that the military and civilians were given the same pay raise. And that is something all of the federal employee groups advocated for, that usually the administration and Congress, regardless of their political party, were very supportive of. And that's gone by the wayside with the three-year pay freeze. And I think it's time we work to restore that.
And it'll be interesting to see that sort of a middle ground between the 3.3% that's out there, which I think most federal employees would be thrilled if we could get a 3.3%. And they certainly deserve a 3.3% pay raise after all the pay freezes. And
the $1 billion they lost in their wages because of sequestration-related furloughs. Yeah, I think those people would probably deserve a 3.3% pay raise.
So, yeah, and you know, there's also cost of living in there, and that stuff doesn't stop, along with increases to health care and other things that I know federal employees have faced. But it'll be interesting to see if Congress actually takes any of this up. I'm a little bit of a skeptic these days.
One thing that is being included in a few of the appropriations bills are limits or bans on performance awards, especially at the managerial and executive level. Given everything that's going on with the VA scandal, several amendments, and some have been included in the MILCON VA appropriations bill in the Senate, would ban performance awards for senior executives there. There's others based on some previous IRS TIGTA reports that would extend bans on performance award bonuses to managers and others at the IRS. So those are definitely issues that we're keeping an eye on in terms of other positive workforce reinforcements for earned performance awards that Congress is also trying to tamp down on.
Yeah, and it would be, you know, again, those are the questions. Some of those bans are not just 1 year for the fiscal year with appropriations. They're multi-year bans on performance awards or other bonuses. On that, too, one of the other things, I was just talking to some folks about travel and relocation issues, and we're still seeing cuts or bans on federal employee travel out there, too, in the appropriations bills, and specifically, you know, capping certain types of travel, capping conferences, you know, or outright banning some of those. And that's certainly something that I haven't seen loosen up yet. And I don't know that it's going to necessarily in the next couple appropriation cycles. So I know a couple of our groups have really pushed to open up the travel because it hurts people in terms of development, training, conferences.
Yeah, and maintaining certifications to do their jobs. And, you know, some of these trainings and some of these conferences that you talk about, you know, are vital for these employees to be able to continue to perform their jobs and provide the services. And so just a blanket ban on travel or conferences is really just not the way to go. You need to take a look at each one of these on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, is this providing, you know, for the common good, then, you know, go ahead and authorize it. You know, none of our groups are looking forward to, you know, are advocating the days of old of, you know, the lavish, you know, things that you hear about. We just want some common sense to applied to it.
Right. And I think, you know, these days most conferences aren't big and they're much more tailored and targeted anyways. I was at a lunch the other day with people from all across the government sector and private sector. And it was amazing to me. I mentioned that I work on federal workforce issues, and all these private sector people said, oh, conference and training issue, because for them, if they're in the travel industry, if they're in states that had hosted these, it's really hurting some of the private sector folks too. You know, some of them are science people, so, you know, and it's this exchange of ideas. So it'd be interesting to see if any of that ever starts shifting in appropriations and they leave that behind. But so far it hasn't happened. Jason, you mentioned the TIGTA report, and that's something that has certainly sparked not just appropriations amendments, but some other legislation as well. And do you want to talk a little bit about what the TIGTA report said and what sparked this?
Sure. So that report came out, I believe, in either March or April, and it basically found that certain employees at the IRS, maybe I think just under 3,000 employees or so, had received performance award bonuses while they also had some other kind of misconduct or tax delinquency issue, whether or not they might have already been in a performance or a repayment plan for those tax issues. But that report coming out led to a flood of legislation coming out, both in the House and the Senate, to either enable the IRS to terminate employees with tax issues or misconduct issues, other bans on performance awards or other monetary incentives for employees, some for just 1 year, some for up to 5 years, regardless of whether it's someone received a one-day suspension or they were charged for misconduct. And I think that's one of the issues that we're really keeping an eye on is trying to kind of educate Congress on the fact that, you know, the penalty really needs to reflect the crime. And if someone is just has a simple reprimand or a one day, they shouldn't, you know, be precluded from a bonus for a full 5 years, because who knows what they might do down the line that would really, you know, warrant them putting forth that extra effort. And those are definitely issues that we're keeping an eye on and working up on the Hill very hard to educate members about these issues.
And these are hard ones because they, you know, nobody likes the idea, soundbite wise, of saying, oh, we gave a bonus to somebody who was potentially tax delinquent or who had some other issue. I mean, I think the bonus issue takes, you know, takes on a life of its own out there. And so it's interesting to see whether people are going to keep on this. It certainly seems like more people are jumping on this bandwagon as more things come out there. The tax delinquent feds issue has been around for a number of years now. I think we've had legislation for at least 4 years, maybe.
I was going to say at least the last two Congresses.
Yeah. So, and basically, and that's potentially moving again.
Yeah. Jenny, I think you hit the nail on the head with something you had, with something you said, that being it's hard to describe these things in a soundbite. That's kind of the world Congress is living in right now. I feel like it's, what do you always like to say, legislating in 140 characters.
Yep.
If it can't fit in a tweet, I'm not going to write legislation on it. And these issues are so complicated. You look at what's going on at the VA and IRS, and if you listen to some of these members of Congress talk, you would think that every single 2 million federal employees were delinquent on their taxes. None of them are paying into the system. They're bleeding taxpayers with their lavish salaries. And I mean, you and I know it's not true, but how do you explain that in a quick soundbite? When members of Congress go up there and saying, you know, federal employees owe, what was it, $3 billion in back taxes. Well, I think we can all agree that the tax code is very, very complicated.
If you filled out your taxes and
your
filed
taxes.
Them yourself, you know it's complicated.
And I think people make mistakes. I'm sure any one of us in this room have done it on our taxes before. You know, you make mistakes, and federal employees are not immune to that. And when we first started dealing with this bill several years ago, I remember one of the staffers saying to Jenny and I, the folks who are delinquent 1 year are not the ones who are delinquent the next. So even though the number of federal employees who are delinquent on their taxes stays about the same, the amount of money owed stays about the same, it's not the same person year after year, which indicates to me that these people made a very understandable mistake. They paid back what they owed the government, and they're continuing to go about their day-to-day business serving our country.
Well, and one of the things I think, you know, IRS being a case, these are the people who administer taxes, and it's one of their 10 deadly sins, mm-hmm. is that if you are willfully tax delinquent, you're fired. I mean, because you can't be administering taxes and be evading them as well. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I suppose you could, but then you're fired. So, you know, so the question is, but the word I put in there is willfully. You know, there's a difference between messing up and you didn't realize you owed taxes on some a gift or a, something that you owe taxes on, and willfully trying to evade taxes, put them in a shelter someplace, doing something like that. And so I think there's also a table of penalties, if I recall correctly there, that has to do with, you know, was it a mistake up to were you really trying to get out of paying your taxes? And so what's your punishment up to termination? Mm-hmm. And that's the part that is not in these bills, is looking at the willfulness, looking at how quickly they were changing it, their status there. And I always think back to the bar they use on tax delinquent federal employee legislation is a lien. Yep. And a lien can be put on for typically $1,000, but it can be anything less than that too. And it gets put on within something like 10 days of tax delinquency. So if you were sick and didn't turn in your taxes, you get a lien on you. And it's difficult. They don't remove it until you've paid every last dollar back, even if you're in a payment plan. And they file them in every county too. So I think it would be very difficult to go through and pull this information on federal employees, and that a manager would know that they could, that that was out there, and take away, not grant a bonus or a performance award. So it's a very difficult, and like Jesse said, it's very complex. None of these are easy bills that are out there.
Well, the thing that, go ahead.
One of the interesting things about that, and like Jesse said, it's you know, if it doesn't fit 140 characters, it's not worth saying. But you know, a report came out recently that had showed the percentages of federal employees versus congressional employees and members of Congress. And I think for the federal workforce, it was about 3% on annual that had tax delinquency issues. And for members of Congress and their staff, that percentage was upwards of 7 or 8%. I know that there's dozens of members of Congress with serious tax issues. So it's hard. There's no one around to turn the camera around and shine that light on them, but they can easily shine it on the federal workforce and use that simple talking point as a bludgeon.
I believe also as a country, Americans are 17% of them are delinquent on their taxes. So you look at all the constituencies and the federal workforce is doing the best. One of the other things that really, really gets me about this bill is that I don't think the unemployed make for very good taxpayers. So perhaps firing someone because they're delinquent on their taxes will not help you recoup that money any faster. Federal employees are subject to the same wage garnishment laws that all other Americans are. If they're not paying their taxes, their wages can be garnered. That's where we should go first.
Right. And that's one of those, look again at the policy, not just at the soundbite on this. And, you know, unfortunately, it's the reality we live in these days. So on that happy note, I'm going to stop here for our mid-show break. And we'll continue with our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
If you're a federal manager, you deal with a lot of information. Here's a tip on breaking through the noise. Join the Federal Managers Association to have a voice on Capitol Hill. And to get filtered news and information specific to managing your workforce, join the 50,000 other federal managers who already subscribe and read the free weekly e-report, fedmanager.com. I'm Todd Wells, Executive Director of the Federal Managers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. and today I'm joined by representatives from Professional Managers Association, Federal Managers Association, and NARF, and I'm not going to say the entire name out there. Thank you for joining me again. And we've been talking about a legislative update on what the federal workforce can expect and is probably hearing about right now on Capitol Hill. And we've been talking about some of the things that have been out there for a long time, and some are moving, some aren't. One of the newer conversations, though, that we haven't touched on, and I don't know if this is going to end up on the Hill or not, but I think everybody's heard about it a lot, is civil service reform. That's something that certainly has been talked about quite a bit. And I've asked you to grab your crystal ball before, but is this something that you think is going to be out there as a legislative issue? Is there any interest in this whatsoever?
My crystal ball says no. Jenny, you and I worked on this a lot back in, 2007, 8, 9 with NSPS. And NSPS was supposed to be like the trial run for the Working for America Act, which came out of the Bush administration across the federal government. And I think since the repeal of NSPS in 2010, legislators are very, very hesitant to take on civil service reform. I think one of the other reasons we're not going to see this happen is because it will undoubtedly cost money.
It's going to be expensive.
Mm-hmm. Because all the rhetoric is you need to pay your top employers. Top employees. You need to incentivize them. We need to pay them market rates. And for a decent chunk of the federal workforce, they are being paid below their counterparts in the private sector. And that means this reform is going to cost money. You don't really see a lot of things moving through Congress right now, especially something as controversial as civil service reform that costs money.
And it's been decades since we've had civil service reform. So some of the ideas out there, and, I do hear offices on the Hill query, is this a good idea? Should we look at it? There's been some talk in hearings in the Senate on, just that topic has been brought up a little bit. But it is a huge lift to reform the civil service. You get into a lot of different areas, and it's not just pay. It's not just benefits. It's not, it really goes into classification systems. It goes into a whole bunch of different things out there. And, I think that that's going to be a tough lift. But I do think that conversation is out there. It's on some people's radar screens, and maybe it takes a tipping point, too, of something. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's wrong to be talking about it because there are clearly issues that need to change, but it's certainly something that I agree I don't think is going anywhere soon.
I think one of the things, too, that civil service reform would force our legislators to ask themselves, and something I think they should be asking themselves, is what do we want from our government? No one's talking about what we want DOD to do, what we want DOE to do, and all the other federal agencies. And let's staff it. Let's fund it accordingly. They just want to cut it without asking themselves, well, what programs don't we want to fund? Maybe there are programs out there that all 535 of them can agree on shouldn't be funded. Doubtful, of course. But, that conversation is not being had. It's cut. We got to cut. And then we're in situations of massive backlogs. And those same, budget members of Congress, appropriations members who cut the funding don't turn around and say, oh, this backlog is my fault. It's your fault, federal employees, because you're not doing your job efficiently.
Yep. And that's something when sequestration was going through, I know a lot of groups said, this is just a complete, you're taking a axe to everything and you're not funding anything appropriately, rather than looking at, the dollars, the people, the resources, whatever else is necessary to do that. And I don't see that conversation coming back.
I don't either. The Working Capital Fund is an excellent example of that. Cutting employees furloughing employees who are not even paid through appropriated dollars, just so everything, can be equal and everyone pays the same price of Congress's inaction. I mean, I can't imagine what it was like being one of those employees.
Frustrating or angering, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And I'd like to echo what Jesse was saying on that. There are things out there. I think it's in early April, the GAO, the duplication report of those sorts of things that are out there. And, GAO puts this report out, and then And it's Congress's responsibility to go in and take a look at that and, try to make some changes. GAO provides this, and you know, we're on board with a lot of that, and you know, we can identify some of those things. And so there are ways to make realistic cuts and changes to make the government more efficient and more effective. And let's give that a try rather than just take a meat cleaver to, you know, to the whole thing and, you know, say, hey, let's lump off 10% or whatever.
Well, and that's interesting because it's, you know, and they're also, what was it? The president used to do the SAVE Awards, mm-hmm. That were out there where he has this website and people put in awards and then they pick some and picked a winner. And some of the ideas out there, I've read through some of them, are really interesting because they come from federal employees in agencies who actually see what's working in little things. And a lot of these changes aren't big. They're not major changes. They don't lose jobs. They don't shift around priorities. But taken together, they save a lot of money. And I saw, you know, there was, I think, Congressman Connolly last session had legislation that lumped a bunch of those SAVE awards together to save money. I haven't seen that effort now. It's almost like the sequestration conversation is gone, that we've embraced. I don't want to say embrace because that's not the right word, but that's the new reality.
I think people are just resigned to the reality that it exists, and Congress simply can't do anything to reverse it. You know, much like the civil service issue, there's glaring problems that need to be addressed. But unfortunately, you know, neither of these are necessarily sexy or interesting issues. They're not a scandal. They're not going to grab the headlines, and it's going to take up a lot of floor time and committee time. And I don't think members are willing to commit to that. And therefore, we're going to just maintain the status quo. And unfortunately for sequestration, that means 8 more years and a lot more tough decisions ahead.
And a lot more cuts, too, if I'm remembering correctly.
I think the reason no one is talking about this, and I try and remind NARF members of this as often as I can, we have a 2-year budget deal, which means that Congress has managed to offset sequestration in some way or another until FY16. And I had a chief of staff on the Hill tell me one time, and I absolutely agree with her, Congress doesn't do anything until the 11th hour. They're not going to take action until they have to, which means where we were at the end of last year with the Ryan Murray budget deal is exactly where we're going to be as we get closer, as we get through September of next year and closer to the start of FY16. And then all the things we've been talking about for the last several years, chain CPI, FEHBP, increase in retirement contributions for current federal employees, pay freezes, all these issues that are all but ignored right now because they don't need to find an offset for sequestration are going to come roaring back, I think, in September of next year. And we as an organization are trying to let these things not slip off the radar of members of Congress's minds. So it's not like it's a new thing when we're right back here trying to offset sequestration a year from now.
Well, and I think a good point. We're all getting lulled into this sense of, we're not fighting as much anymore. You know, federal employee issues are somewhat off the table.
Right.
And that may not be true in a year from now, you know, that this is, it's just sort of slowed down for a while, but that those proposals, once they're out there, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. People know that they can go there to offset, you know, other bills. They can use it to make cuts that are, quote unquote, easier, you know, to do. So
I said at a meeting earlier this week, you know, new federal employees are now paying 4.4% for their retirement benefits without any increase in those benefits. That's almost 6 times as much as current FERS employees, those hired before 2013, pay. And I don't think there are certain members of Congress, House in particular, House leadership in particular, that are not going to rest until every single federal employee's retirement contributions are increased by anywhere from 6% to 7%. They know how much money it saves. They know current federal employees have not had any increases to their retirement contributions, which, I attribute to those organizations in this room as well as others in the federal community. But this issue isn't going away just because no one's talking about it right now.
Right. And that's the one thing that everybody has to keep, you know, banging the hammer. Hey, it's banging the drum. It's out there. You know, we need to stay on top of this so it doesn't come sliding back in someplace. And, you know, and I think FEHBP is another one where there have been, you know, talks about changing it, talks about, changing the percentage employees pay, whether you turn it to, you know, a voucher program. They're having that conversation about VA right now and the benefits we give to veterans and privatizing some of that. And so So it'll be interesting to see how much of that kind of creeps over into what they do with FEHB. And let's not forget the members of Congress are, you know, and their staffs are no longer on FEHB. Well, most staff. There are some who are. So do you think that's going to play a factor in opening the door to FEHBP changes?
Actually, yes, I do. It makes me incredibly nervous now that members of Congress and most of their staff is no longer in FEHBP. They have less of a reason to defend it. However, provided that staff stays in the, and the member of Congress stays in the healthcare exchange until they retire, they are able to go back into FEHBP when they retire, which I think is a saving grace for the program. Committee staff, most of those who, you know, spend a lot of time writing legislation, and you know, legislation theoretically should go through committee first, most of them stayed in FEHBP. So I also think that is going to help our cause.
And there were regulations that gave them subsidies, right? Doesn't the employer pay a portion of their exchange as well?
The members' offices, or the federal government, however you want to call it, pays the same towards their healthcare exchanges premiums as they would have had they still been under FEHBP, so 72% on average.
Right. So, you know, so there are still some trappings there. So they
absolutely
mean that it'll be a little bit harder to change that, but that conversation has certainly been out there as well. Mm-hmm. And I think on that note, we'll take our final break here and stop and hear a word from our sponsor. When we return, we'll wrap up our discussion. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're entering the last segment of the show, and we've been talking about legislation that may or may not affect federal employees and just some of those things that are out there broadly that have been on the horizon. And one of those issues, you know, earlier we were talking about NDAA appropriations, things where we're seeing stuff affect federal employees that gets tacked on to that. And I think one of those big things, as Jesse reminded me, is postal reform, is that that's a big issue in and of itself. Postal reform is obviously something people have talked about and affects every district, you know, across the country. It affects all Americans, but it also has a lot in there that affect federal employees. This isn't just about rural post offices or days that postal delivery is. There's workers' comp, there's healthcare, there's some other things in there.
Sure. Happy to talk about postal anytime. There are a lot of postal bills out there. It seems like our committee chairman, Daryl Issa, comes out with a different postal bill every week. I will focus for the purposes of this discussion on the Senate postal bill, because if there is going to be any postal reform this Congress, which I think overall is highly unlikely, it will probably be the Senate bill that came out of committee in February. And yes, as Jenny said, this is incredibly important for all federal employees and retirees. You should all be paying attention. This is not just about whether or not you're going to get your mail on Saturday or how far you have to drive to your nearest post office. There are three things in the Senate postal bill that I think federal employees and postal employees and retirees alike should be aware of. One, it vastly changes the workers' compensation structure for those who are injured on the job. And make no mistake about it, it sharply decreases benefits to those who are injured on the job. Secondly, it also allows the Postal Service to bargain over retirement benefits for new postal employees. That means they could not only eliminate FERS, which is specifically stated in the legislation, they could eliminate FERS, leaving new hires with only Social Security and TSP, but it also allows the Postal Service to bargain over their TSP contributions. And when you're talking about a cash-strapped agency, which way do you think those TSP contributions are going to go? And third, it creates a new postal benefits health benefit, Postal Service health benefits plan, putting all postal employees and retirees into their own pool. We believe the plans available in those pools will closely mimic FEHBP. I have no concerns about the quality, I have very little concerns, I should say, about the quality of those plans. The kicker with that is that it requires anyone who receives benefits, both federal retirees, postal retirees, and their spouses who are of age 65, requires them to enroll in Medicare Part B. I think the FICA provisions are workforce-wide. The other two, retirement and health benefits, sets the stage for these things to happen throughout the rest of the federal government.
Right. It's the foot in the door thing. Mm-hmm. Once you can change it for one sector of federal employees or public employees, postal there, how easy is it to change it for others?
Yep. And I think Medicare and requiring enrollment, specifically in Medicare Part B, is something that if the Postal Service goes that way, I think you'll see start to be talked about for FEHBP the minute that becomes law.
Right. And that's something that idea has been floating around for a while. And so it just gives, if people have voted on it, makes it, you know, much more difficult to say, well, don't support it this time because mm-hmm. member of Congress, you already voted yes on it mm-hmm. once before for a different sector. So I know a lot of the groups you guys all in this room have opposed the workers' comp reform or have had changes to it, you would do it differently than what was out there. I know FMA has been involved in that as well.
That, yeah, with on FICA reform, we would like to see a retirement provision. We have, I hear from our members across the country who they have people at their installations who are in their late 80s, early 90s, who are still getting the full FICA benefits, and you know, there's obviously no chance that they're going to come back to the active roles and come back. And so we would like to see some change to that of when you hit, I don't know, the Social Security retirement age, 66, 67, that the FICA reform or that your FICA benefits also change to go along and you go into retirement. Because the other thing is there's no survivor benefit. And so we had a person out at Travis Air Force Base that her husband was receiving FICA benefits. And when he passed away, his widow went in to collect the survivor benefit, and they had to tell her regrettably, sorry, you know, we don't have anything for you. And so we want to see some change to that as well on FICA reform.
And some of those, it's a difficult issue because you're talking about people who have been injured on the job and who have been, you know, depends on when they were injured, how much they were making prior. And so I know it's been a little bit of a contentious issue on how you actually do this and close those loopholes.
Sure.
So it's certainly, you know, there are various plans out there, but I don't think there are any federal employee groups that are supporting what's out there right now in terms of the actual postal bills. So it's certainly something. I don't know if postal's going to move. That's interesting. If any of those bills will move forward, it's unclear right now.
It would play out under one of two scenarios. Senate Democratic leadership is not pleased with the current bill. None of, like you mentioned, none of the federal employee groups, but also none of the postal groups are in favor of this legislation as a whole. There are pieces we all agree on, there are pieces we all disagree on, but as a whole, everyone's opposed to this legislation. Senate Democratic leadership will not let this hit the floor in its current form. You know, certain changes would have to be made. From what I understand, FICA is very, very high on that list. However, if you change the bill, you will lose the support of a lot of the Republicans, most notably Senator Coburn. This is his last year in Congress. Postal reform is high on his priority list. Him and Carper agreed to this bill. You know, from their perspective, this is a bipartisan bill. So I don't know how much Chairman Carper is going to be willing to give, knowing that he will lose the support of Senator Coburn in the process. My crystal ball tells me, and out of every crystal ball prediction I've made today, I think this is probably the one where I could be wrong. My crystal ball tells me we don't see postal reform until the lame duck session of Congress.
And I think you may be, you know, I my crystal ball kind of, you know, if I'm looking into it, I kind of lean that direction as well. And I see other heads nodding. That...
Sure.
Well, and looking at where the elections are taking place this year with the balance of the Senate possibly up in the air with many red state Democrats up, it is possible that that will be the time where this legislation is finished off and taken past the finish line. And I know that does concern many of our groups, if not all of them.
Absolutely. And from what we understand, too, last Congress, right before the end of the 112th Congress, the two chambers and both parties were very, very close to a deal on postal. And that could very well, again, be the case at the end of this Congress.
Right. You never know. Now, a lot of the big legislation goes at the end of Congress. You know, mm-hmm. we see it in November, December mm-hmm. is when all of a sudden it picks up steam and boom, there it is, out
Especially
the door.
Especially if you are a lame duck member of Congress and you no yep. longer have to be held accountable for the votes you're casting, or for those senators, if you just got reelected, that's not a vote you're going to be held accountable for another 6 years.
Right.
Because you're not up again for that long time. So, yeah, it's very possible this lame duck could be very, very busy, especially if the balance of power switches in the Senate.
Yeah. Speaking of something that passed at the end of a year or two ago, phased retirement, that was something that was one of those. It was in a big package. It passed, you know, as part of something else. But it was something that all the federal employee groups broadly supported, was giving this right to allow federal employees to phase out towards the retirement work, you know, half time. There was a mentoring component to it. You know, yet another one of those good workforce tools like reemployed annuitants. But this is the other side of the coin. Once you get a law passed, it has to be implemented. There have to be regulations. There have to be you know, it has to be put into place and actually carried out. And that's something that hasn't happened yet. And so
it has not. and let me tell you, I am reminded on a very regular basis from NARF members waiting for this option that this is not yet available. President signed that bill, which was a larger transportation bill, into law on July 6th of 2012. So we are nearing the 2-year anniversary of when the phased retirement law passed. A year ago, OPM released the draft regulations. NARF, along with several other groups, submitted comments on those draft regulations. Overall, they were pretty good. We had some minor concerns that we would like to see fixed. So it's a year after that point in time, and these regulations are not yet out. OPM Director Archuleta said on Federal News Radio last week, she expects that they will be out and ready for agencies to start implementing by the start of the fiscal year.
So that's something everybody can look forward to. And we hope that is, in fact, the case, because I know a lot of groups, everybody's hearing from employees that are waiting to use this authority and agencies that are waiting to use this authority. One of the other regulations I know I'd like to see come out that hasn't come out yet is the Flag for the Fallen regs that allows federal employees killed in the line of duty for their survivors to receive a flag, so in honor of their service. And that's another one that it passed in 2011. Mm-hmm. And we've seen, you know, some drafts, but we haven't seen the final regulations come out. So we can only hope that all of those are forthcoming very soon. Well, we're getting close to the end of our show. And are there any other, you know, 20-second issues that are out there that you think federal employees need to know about? Or are these really the big ones?
I think these are most of the big ones. You know, one thing that I just raised briefly is that security clearance reform is moving forward. I know that the administration has done some work on this. Congress is continuing to look at solutions and legislation that can advance this process. And we're monitoring this issue just to see where it goes and what the end point is.
Yeah, and I know that's something FMA is monitoring. So looking forward to getting something going here.
Absolutely. We've been working with Susan Collins in the Senate on some legislation. And so I certainly hope something goes forward to try to prevent an Aaron Alexis or Edward Snowden event in the future.
Right. There's been some big issues. It's certainly something that really should be looked at. And hopefully some of these other scandals don't knock it off the radar screen. Well, I want to thank all of you for joining me today. Very helpful. And we'll bring you back again after the recess to see what's going on in August.
Thanks, Jenny.
Thanks,
thank
Jenny.
You. And that's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks for joining us. Fed Talk is brought to you by the federal employment law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Have a good weekend.